I'm going to give a somewhat more classical talk tonight, classical Theravada Buddhist talk. But it'll tie in, I think, nicely to some of the places that we've been going lately. A lot of the emphasis over the last months here has been into awareness itself, into the non-dual nature of awareness, that there isn't someone who is aware, there is awareness. When there is a sense of someone, that's an idea that awareness sees. Awareness sees the idea that there's someone who is aware. It's that simple. We've also been talking about freedom, the truth, reality. We've been using these words somewhat synonymously, that the truth of a human nature is freedom. That's the essence or the heart of the Dharma. Dharma is the Sanskrit word for truth. The way things really are, not as we think they are, not as we might believe they are, not as we've been told they are, but the way things really are. I've also been talking about the nature of transformation and how nothing lasts, and also been edging that up to how do we approach life in such a way so that we're not frightened or inhibited by it, and particularly not inhibited by things like death. Because death is natural. It's as natural as breathing, it's as natural as birth, it's as natural as anything. So why be afraid or apprehensive about that which is natural? And of course, part of the answer is because the human mind, the conditioned mind, clings to what it perceives to be existence, myself, the body, the mind. It can, not that it must, but it can, to varying degrees, cling to this. And when it clings to this, even in the face of the logical or rational awareness that this is impermanent, this doesn't last, that, you might say, cognitive dissonance, is a friction that can be resolved. And it can be resolved by meditation itself. It can be resolved by the nature of insight that arises in meditation. But meditation is not essential for insight to arise. Insight, seeing the truth clearly, can arise at any moment, at any time. It just so happens that meditation helps assist in this. Meditation, you might say, prepares the garden for insight to arise. A little bit more, perhaps, than going down to the pub and having a beer. Although that would possibly alter something. Relax one. Put one in a more parasympathetic rather than sympathetic fight-or-flight nervous system mode. But it wouldn't necessarily generate insight. Otherwise, everyone down at the pub right now would be getting free. And they might think they are, but actually just have a good look, folks, at what's really going on in there. The lights are dimmed there, the lights are up here. Okay, so that's a lead-in. Oh, I should read this because this is what stimulated tonight's talk. This was something that came in the email. It's a good question. And it covers a little bit about what I just said. We talk about insight, awareness, impermanence, not to be attached, struggles, death, etc. How do we find joy in any of this? At times, I'm not sure what that means exactly, but they strike me as boredom, depression, and at times laziness. What is joy? How do we have humor? Where is the space for passion, energy, and enthusiasm? There's a few good questions in there, right? It's all pointing into a really important area. So let's go into it a little bit. The New York Times writer, columnist David Brooks, very I think, good journalist, good author, written several books about character and dignity and things like this. He said that those who find joy are often involved in the search for something else, and joy comes as a byproduct. So, you know, you see this all over the place. You see people who love what they do, you know. It could be a bicyclist, they could be, you know, a guitarist, you know, they could be a child playing on a playground and just loving to get back on that swing. And they are doing something that they enjoy. And as they do this that they enjoy, joy comes. If you shoot directly for joy, it will often elude you. Because, of course, like every state, not to diminish joy, but every state comes and goes. So if you're fixated on a state, you actually limit the range of your experience somewhat, right? And if you fixate on your knee, if your knee is painful, if you fixate on your knee, you miss other things. You fixate on what you don't have, and you miss other things. Yes, Sean.
Can joy come without the precondition of the thing you're shooting for?
Absolutely. There's what's called causeless joy. Causeless joy. We'll get to that as the talk goes on. There's causes for joy, and then there's causeless joy. We don't hear about this very much, and we don't usually read about causeless joy. You have to dig deep. Into the teachings to find that kind of information or that kind of pointing out. It's not really information, it's pointing out. Yeah, when words work, they point directly to that which the word represents. And then when it really works, when the word really points out, well, the word disappears. So joy isn't the word joy. Yeah. Okay, so there are seven factors, there we go, seven factors of awakening, or seven factors in the Buddhist teaching that are called enlightenment, seven factors of enlightenment. This is a very great teaching, classical Buddhist teaching. Many of you may have heard this before. I've heard it many times in my life. I've heard it from different teachers, and of course it's always a bit different. But the seven factors, yeah, those are the same. So let's go into these seven factors. Three of the seven are what are called arousing factors. And three of the seven are called stabilizing factors. And one of the seven is integrating all the other six. So it's a family. Okay? Let's go with the arousing factors first. What are the arousing factors in life and in meditation? And the first is very, very critical. The first is investigation. Look at humans, those who investigate deeply. Einstein, Fridtjof Capra, physicist who's come later than Einstein. Artists who investigate, musicians who investigate, anybody who investigates, children who investigate. Investigation means to look deeply into something. You look deeply into something like a blade of grass, and then you begin to see the blade of grass maybe slightly moving with the wind. You become absorbed, you become intrigued, you become fascinated. It's wonderful to be interested, and out of that interest to investigate anything. So investigation, based upon interest, is the first factor of awakening, is the first factor of enlightenment. And it's a wholesome quality of mind, isn't it? When we're investigating. And I mean investigating now meditatively more than conceptually, although you can investigate conceptually. You can go into thinking deeply, work on a problem, sort something out, come up with a decision maybe. That's one kind. The deeper kind of investigation doesn't involve thought. It involves how awareness functions with regards to experience. It's specifically pointing at what happens in meditation practice. So this investigation Okay? Very, very critical. Very central. We don't really get going in this area of what's our potential really about without investigation. In some traditions, it's called earnestness. Earnestness. Or you could stretch it in and call it sincerity. Being sincere. You're too rigid, you miss the open, spacious, yet focused quality of sincerity, and you get serious. You get contracted. You become like a robot trying to meditate. One time when I was learning walking meditation and I had no idea what I was doing, right? I completely got lost in my head and I did the whole thing mathematically. 2 inches, 4 inches, da 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 da, and I wrote it all down. Okay, and all we were supposed to do was note the different parts of the walking. Lifting, moving, stepping, shifting, those four parts. And just do that in such a way and then investigate what happens there, what comes out of that experientially. So I got lost in my head thinking I was doing what the instructions suggested. And I wrote out everything that happened in great detail, feeling very good about myself. I went to the teacher and she looked at what I had written. I handed it to her like a kid handing in the paper. See, I did my assignment. And she looked at it and she said, "That's totally wrong." I went, "What?" She said, "That's not what this is at all." She clearly recognized what I had done. I didn't. She said, "You were in your head the whole time mapping this out, you know, like it was some kind of jungle gym." And she said, and then she directed me back to what it really was about. And then I thought, "Yeah, that is what you said." So the mind took it and went for a ride and thought it was investigating, but really it was just up in its, you know, its thoughts about things. Okay, you're not going to find joy, happiness, fulfillment if you keep staying in your thoughts about everything. Okay, why do we have a heart? Why do we have a heart that feels and a body that's animated with life force if we're just supposed to think about things? Somebody today told me about an article. You know the Sun magazine? These quite diverse writers will write in this magazine. It's called the Sun. You know it, Chloe? No? Anybody know the Sun? Anybody?
Sun?
Huh? No. Not like Angel Sun. It's published up in I think maybe North Carolina. It comes out with a vinyl copy. It's very, very good. I would recommend you look at it. I used to subscribe to it and get it regularly. Really quite diverse, very, very good writers. Anyways, one, I think he's a physician, was writing about this, this was about 4 years ago, he's writing about this evolving interface between the gut and the information coming up scientifically about the importance of the gut and the brain. That what's happened here, you know, and we're still somewhat caught in this, we're actually, you know, still up here a bit too much. And that more and more information, scientific, very sound research information is arising about the importance of the gut. And almost to the point where they're talking about it as a brain itself, you know, stretching the meaning of that word a bit as we often use it. And I reflected on this a little bit and I thought, oh yes, of course. I remember hearing Descartes' famous statement, "I think, therefore I am." What Descartes missed was that before he uttered that, "I think, therefore I am," there was this great utterance which echoes through all time, which is, "I am that I am." But anyways, "I think, therefore I am." Well, what about "I feel, therefore I am"? What about "I sense, therefore I am"? What about the gut feeling? What about the heart? So investigation involves much more than just being cognitively aware. Getting into the senses, really what that contact with the so-called world really is. Okay, that's the investigation. My cheat sheet in my pocket, I think. Which pocket is it in? I don't make notes very often, but I want to get this right. Okay, so I was talking about how investigation gives rise to energy. And energy is sometimes viewed as effort. Now, ultimately, when we get into the Eightfold Path of the Buddha, and it gets to right effort is ultimately no effort. It's the release from trying. But in order to get to the place where there is a balance that allows for the release of trying, there often needs to be effort. But that effort needs to be the right kind of effort. It can't be too tight, it can't be too pushed, and it can't be too lax. It needs to be balanced. This is also called energy. And it's the same thing for any activity. You don't hold your pen too tight, your pencil too tight. You don't grab the handlebars too tight. You can't play a guitar if you can't keep a loose wrist. You know? You don't want to be overusing your voice or underusing your voice, overusing your joints or underusing your joints. There's this ongoing, intuitive, instinctual sense of the right amount of energy for things that we're doing. Am I making sense? So if you're doing Tai Chi or something like this, or you're lifting weights, you know, you don't push harder than you need to. You push just enough. Unless, I don't know, you're trying to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm not going to try to imitate him because I can't do the voice. Yeah, I tried. There's some comedians who can do Arnold Schwarzenegger like perfect. You know, they just like make the sounds just like him. I guess that takes effort and investigation and energy. And nothing else to do with your life. So energy gives rise to the third arousing factor. So we've got investigation, energy or effort, and then the third is what's called rapture, which is also translated as joy. Okay, now this is how this works. If you do anything and you do it fully enough, you do it engaged enough, you will become joyful. When the word rapture is used, okay, this is specific to what happens if you meditate intensively and deeply. You'll get goose flesh. You'll begin to get into this area of causeless joy, Sean, where there won't be anything that makes any sense in your mind at all about why you're so happy. And I remember this coming a few times when I was practicing intensively, and I was just overwhelmed, just laughing, crying, for no reason that I could identify as this rapture came up. You get a little bit in balance with that because you start to feel very altered, actually. Okay, and there's a lot of monks sitting around in rapture. I'll tell you a quick story about one. I used to meditate with this monk up in Highville, West Virginia. Highville, West Virginia is right on the West Virginia-Virginia border, northern Virginia. And it's in what I call a fjord, which is like a fjord. It usually has water in between, but take out the water and just put a road, okay? Got the picture? You drive down this road in between these mountains, in the wilderness, quiet, and you come to this monastery. It's a forest monastery. It's the first forest monastery in the United States, Theravada Buddhist Forest Monastery. And there's a monk, I think he's still alive there, named Bhante Gunaratna, wrote a classic book called, anybody know that book? Mindfulness in Plain English. That's a good title. It's a great book, by the way. Anyways, Bhante was the priest for the local Washington, D.C., which is due east of Highville, West Virginia, and slightly south. He is the, I would say, high priest for the Sri Lankan community in Washington, D.C. Bhante Gunaratna is from the same country. Saranji is from Sri Lanka. And Bhante was a monk as a young boy, and he didn't like it, so he ran away. He took off. He just split. And they went and got him and brought him back. Like a dog that escaped. Where do you think you're going? This is where you live. You're supposed to be meditating. You're learning the Dharma. In getting to know him, there was points where I was into sponsoring people. And then I figured that I was I didn't need to sponsor anybody. I thought, you know, I'll just let somebody else do the sponsoring. But I used to sponsor a lot of teachers back in the day, and Bhante was one of the teachers. And we were riding in my old Volvo, 240 DL, you know, blue Volvo, piece of junk. I was always afraid it was going to die, and then it did on I-4, straight between Tampa and Orlando, and the temperature was like 96, and we had both kids in the back, and the thing just like went, barely could get it off the road. You know, this is the part that deals with humor right here. Anyways, I was like, my immediate thought is the thing died, and then we pulled it off the road, got to, and the cars are whipping by, you know, we get just enough space, and it's ridiculous, it's wicked hot. I said, I'm going to kill this car. And sure enough, I just got rid of it pretty quickly. That's not what I wanted to really tell you. Anyways, we were riding in the Volvo out by the mall, okay, and it's equally hot day, and my daughter's in the back seat, and she's about, I don't know, maybe 18 months, she's a baby, she's in the back seat, in the car seat. And she's, like, agitated. She's upset, you know, and I look at Bhante, and I'm driving, and I, you know, we're in traffic. You know how it is around the mall? It's like everybody suddenly becomes focused. If you weren't focused before, all of a sudden it's a highway, it's a stores, food, you know, I don't know what it is, but it's like, it goes like that there a lot. You notice that? Or is that just me? The hospital's right there, you know. Things are happening. And so I look in at Bhante and I was like, do something. You know, would you just like help? And he was like clueless. He just looked at me like, it's like he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to handle a child. And I was like, that's the failure of the monastic community. So anyways, back to his monastery. I went there to meditate by myself because I really wanted to get enlightened. And so I figured the best way to do it was to meditate as much as possible. And so he had these kutis, which are like an Eastern word for like a shack. And they're small and there's just enough room for you to sort of sleep in there. Very rustic, extremely rustic. I kind of liked it. I really did. And so I'm meditating. I'm very serious. I'm meditating, get concentrated, you know. And so I have to go down to the main hall to have lunch. And you really take your chances, you know, at a place like that. Like, what are you going to get? How much grease is there going to be in the food? It turned out this lunch was the greasiest thing I think I ever had put in my body. And that wasn't that bad, you know. I looked at the food and I went, you got to eat, don't you? What are you going to eat? The cook looked like he had just climbed out of the gutter. But Bhante, and he had a few other monks with him, was just super fine. And so, you know, I go into the main hall, and I sit down in the middle. I don't know what I was thinking. I was kind of like where you are, but out in the middle, just sitting there like that, just like with my food. And all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, came these Sri Lankans from Washington, D.C., like carloads of Sri Lankans come flying into the hall, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm into silence. And they're like loud, and you know, they're like kids jumping everywhere, and they're, Bhante's like, they almost started like, yeah, it was just crazy. And I'm like, I felt trapped. I was in the middle, and I started to have a lot of anxiety, and I probably just went like this. And I looked up, and there was like different Sri Lankans coming at me with deviled eggs. And there was these deviled eggs appearing. And they started plying the deviled eggs in there. They're like, deviled eggs. And they, like, I needed deviled eggs. I think they would. And it overwhelmed me even more. Because all I wanted to do was meditate. And I got stuck in this hall with deviled eggs coming at me. And plus, I was into silence. So I couldn't say anything, right? Isn't that stupid? All I could have said was, no thank you, or go away, or... So then I looked up, and I saw Bhante, and he was rolling with laughter. He was up on this little stage, because he's the high priest, right? He's got the monks around him, he's up on the stage, and he's laughing so hard at me, stuck in the middle, with deviled eggs. It was a nightmare during the day. It was terrible. It went on for a long time, and then finally I was like, I'm gonna leave. I'm just going to leave the food and I'm going to run away. I'm going to go back to my kuti and cross my legs and try to get centered. There wasn't a lot of joy in that. Until later, when I started to think about it and share it from time to time with folks like you. So anyways, joy.
You think he tells that story too?
What's that now?
You think he tells that story?
I don't know. That would be a good one. Once upon a time, there was this white boy who showed up from Florida and was very serious and thought he was going to get enlightened in the kuti. That one over there. Then he came down to eat, and the Sri Lankans took care of him. They fixed him up. Well, we'll show you what enlightenment looks like. It looks like a deviled egg. So anyways, the joy that comes in meditation is very specific, and it doesn't last, but it's extremely refreshing. And think about the last time you had, maybe you've never had this, you had an exhilaration that created goose flesh in your body, not out of fear, but out of happiness. That's the rapture when it's the strongest. And if you do a concentration practice, which is the first time I started to experience this, like if we just focused on our breathing and really focused on our breathing and stayed with that and concentrated and concentrated and concentrated, we'd go into rapture. We'd go into what's called a jhanic concentration state. And there's a number of different jhanas of concentration. They're not things that people typically experience. You have to meditate intensively to have that kind of experience typically. And it's far more exhilarating and fulfilling than any kind of substance or drug that a person could take that alters their perception, like LSD or something like that. Miles, miles, miles past that. And it's inherent within you. It's inherent within the neurology, the hormonal, the conscious, alive, animated structure of the intelligence that is within this body-mind process. And it's meditation specifically that has tapped that. So, got it? Investigation, energy, rapture, joy, arousing factors. Now, the three balancing factors. Tranquility. That's calm, concentration, and third, equanimity. So let's look at each of these. Tranquility, lovely state. There's probably some tranquility in our daily life every day. It's subtle, we may miss it, but if we're sensitive, if we're tuned in, if we're earnest, if we're investigative, if we're living an investigative life, then we will experience this tranquility more frequently. I remember experiencing it in intensive meditation, and I thought, oh, you have to meditate intensively, in order to feel this tranquility. And sure enough, in those days, it was like that. And then I would just be doing anything. You know, like I remember being in George Bush International Airport in Houston, Texas, in between delayed flights. People going everywhere. And just this tranquility, just poof. All kinds of sound, doesn't matter. All kinds of activity, bustle, bustle, doesn't matter. Not dependent on silence, just tranquility. If you've opened up to calm, if you've opened up to tranquility, if your system is accustomed to it, it happens more and more easily, more and more readily, more and more spontaneously. And it's a very nice factor. Peace. It also involves the diminishment of brainwave activity. So as we go into relaxation, out of that sympathetic fight-or-flight mode, activity, brain with more blood in it, skeletal muscles for action. Now the blood is going more internal, parasympathetic state, going down into the abdomen, blood rate, heart rate slowing down, brainwave frequency slowing down. Haven't gone to sleep yet, calmness, tranquility is in there. And then sleep. A lot of calmness and tranquility in sleep, but it's unconscious. Concentration. Concentration is like a circle inside a bigger space, a circle without any perimeter. That's awareness. So concentration happens inside awareness. The body is happening inside awareness. Body's like a circle inside awareness. So concentration then is that capacity to focalize the attention on something specific like breathing or body or sound, or in the old days it was a mantra. If you do a mantra meditation and you concentrate on it, you'll get a lot of tranquility, relaxation, and maybe sleepiness. Mine just stopped. That was interesting. That's not part of the talk. People confuse concentration with meditation. Meditation is life. Concentration is something that happens in life. Concentration is very wholesome, very good quality. Look at what happens to human beings when they're not concentrated. Or when they're concentrated with confused, deluded motivations. I don't need to give examples right now, do I? You can fill it in yourself, can't you? Concentration with deluded, greedy, confused, bias, prejudice, motivations. Ouch. Leads to havoc. But there's concentration there. People get very concentrated sometimes when they're angry. It's not very wholesome. You see, so what happens is we begin to recognize what concentration is, and we begin to allow it to develop more in our life through whatever we're doing, including, if you like, meditation. This is why most people, that I know at least, when they meditate, probably some of the time, are aware of their breathing. Were you not aware of your breathing at all during this 45-minute sit tonight? Anybody not feel the breath at all? Great. No? No breath? Were you?
No, I wasn't aware of it. I was kind of trying to let silence just kind of take you.
Is that why I saw you like this?
Probably.
I'm just kidding.
A little bit. Right.
But it's there all the time. So in Daryl's case there, he was concentrating on the silence. You see, the silence can take the mind or body into itself. You see, so concentration is there. But remember, it's like a circle inside a bigger circle that isn't got a boundary, that doesn't have a perimeter. That's awareness. And then there's equanimity. The first intensive meditation that I learned involved two of these factors. And one of the two was equanimity. And the second was the very last factor, the integrative factor, awareness itself or mindfulness. It emphasized these two. Didn't really go into the other ones in much detail, just emphasized equanimity and awareness, equanimity and awareness. And it was very effective. The other factors were in there, but they weren't really drawn out. They weren't really given a lot of care and attention, and they weren't talked about as much. So equanimity becomes extremely important when we're dealing with difficulties, whether it be mental, emotional, or physical, any difficulties in our life. the difference between being reactive, which is the ignorance-based, conditioned mind manifesting in this push-pull relationship with experience, fighting, struggling. That's called reactivity. And everyone's mind has this capacity to be reactive. Okay, I'm not talking about the reaction that gets your hand off the hot stove. That's a good instinct, get your hand off the hot stove. I'm talking about the mental reaction of fighting with what's happening or holding on to something that you don't want to go away. Right, this is painful. Equanimity is responsiveness, not reactivity. Responsiveness. It's that responsiveness of mind. It's that capacity to relax around and with what's happening. So I had this surgery on my face recently. They had this, I forget what he called it, but it was right near my eye. It was like a skin tag, that's the word. And I had it looked at, and they said, well, it's probably not cancerous, but you should probably take it off. So I was like, okay. So we went through the procedure. And then when we went to do it, okay, you know, the guy did his thing. He did it pretty quickly. And as he did it, I just opened up into the sensation. You know, I just opened up into the sensation of, it was quite sharp, actually, very brief. And he goes, oh, he goes, you're good at relaxing. So breathe into it, just let it happen. As opposed to, you know, I think what he was probably implying is that a lot of people go like that, you know. They struggle or fight or, you know, ouch! So the relaxing, the responsiveness is extremely healthy and wholesome in relation to everything, particularly the meditation, though. Now, here we are sitting, relatively comfortable room, relatively comfortable temperature. And if you're sitting and discomfort arises, it's coming from within. The room atmosphere is not creating this. The conditioning that's inside the system will have as part of its expression tensional patterns that will arise when we sit. And if those are met with equanimity, they unfold themselves, they dissolve. And the whole system is improved because of that. Meditation is being more and more studied as something incredibly healthy, not just as stress reduction, but for the whole immune system, the whole brain, all of the organs, the muscles, everything is enhanced. The health of it's enhanced through meditation. This research is becoming more and more available. People who know this don't need the research because they just know it experientially. It doesn't mean you won't get cancer maybe and die at 90 or whatever, you know. You're still gonna, body's still gonna die. Might live healthier along the way. So equanimity turns out to be really handy in traffic jams. When someone's riding your butt, things aren't going your way during the political season. Equanimity, very, very handy. And then finally, to wrap the whole of the six together, none of these things can be known, none of these things can be practiced without awareness. Awareness is the base of your life. It's the foundation of your being. The foundation of your being is awareness. And so it is awareness that allows these other factors to be recognized. And it is awareness that ties these factors together into a balanced, synergistic structure. Because you can have, as I mentioned, too much energy going and not enough equanimity. You could have an over-focused, concentrated mind that's actually become fixated, that isn't open investigatively. So it turns out that these factors, work synergistically in combination with one another. And they're here, happening right now in all of us to varying degrees. What the teachings and meditation does is it helps draw them out so that we can recognize them and we can cultivate them like different parts of the garden. And it is this cultivation, Sean, it is this synergistic alchemy of these that brings a human to their potential. Where joy or happiness arises more and more easily without any conscious cause. Because the nature of your being, the very nature of your being is joy, is happiness. And it's happiness and it's joy. It's not dependent on anything particular. It's not dependent on things being a certain way or not being a certain way. This is why a person can be meditating and there could be pain of different kind and they're smiling. They're actually happy. Not because they're masochistic, but because they're sitting in a place of transcendence of the difficulty. That's joyful. Bye-bye. Let's see what else was on that question. Did I say what joy is? Joy is you. I had a neighbor named Joy Peck when I was a kid. They lived next door, the Pecks. And Joy Peck was always smiling. I remember that. Joy Peck is the one who gave me my first yoga book that I tried to do a full spinal twist on the first day and almost like wrecked myself and then gave the book back. Joy Peck was happy a lot.
Paul, I think there's a book called The Joy of Being out there somewhere. Would you say that being is joy?
Yeah. Being, the nature of being is joy. The nature of being is happiness. The nature of being is free. The true nature of being. But also the nature of being is everything. So the nature, this is being. Everything is being. Okay? All things are being. So, where is the space for passion, energy, and enthusiasm? It's right in our being. But we have to tap into that. Now, a lot of times what people do is they tap into passion, energy, enthusiasm through specific activities, and that's fine. So when we talk about investigation or interest, people get interested in a subject. It could be a subject that they really like. That's fine. You ever watch Keith Jarrett play the piano? Watch a YouTube of Keith Jarrett playing the piano. Okay, Keith Jarrett not only is one of the greatest jazz pianists probably ever, but Keith Jarrett from the age of like 4 or 5 was recognized to have perfect pitch. And when Keith Jarrett plays the piano, okay, he can play whatever he's playing. Okay, he's so into it. Okay, he's just so into it with his body, you know, he's moving his body around. It's quite a show. Okay, I recommend this. He's been around a long time. I think he's in his 60s now. I knew about him, you know, 40 years ago. Went to a concert and saw him play live once. So he's unusual. I mean, he's a protege from a very young age, and he's highly, highly skilled at what he does. And he's a genius, really, in certain ways, musically. What I'm speaking about, though, isn't so much an activity that someone is inclined into that gives them passion, energy, enthusiasm. I'm talking about recognizing that inborn capacity for passion, energy, and enthusiasm that's actually already within you, and that's what meditation helps open up. Doesn't mean you can't also be thoroughly interested in some activity, you know, that you're engaged in, some project or some service work. I have a friend who does what's called community organizing. He lives in Asheville, North Carolina. He used to live here. And when he lived here, he did this community organizing, which was this thing that interfaced politics and religion. Juicy, huh? Politics and religion. And it brought people together, both from the political sector and the religious sector, and it created these community events that were focused on service, specific things that were needed in the community. And he knew how to do this. And I remember going to one of these meetings. It was at a local church over on the east side of town. The place was packed. Okay, he had all of the city commissioners there. The mayor was there. He had all these ministers there, and tons of people. And I was like, holy smokes. What energy, what enthusiasm. And I'm like, my friend Nick organized this. He pulled this off. What? How did he do that? I got to know him a little bit, and he said, I learned from a master of this kind of work. I learned from this man. As soon as I recognized who this man was, I just wanted to get under his wing. And I did. I got under his wing, and I learned how to do this. He's doing it now up in Asheville. And they don't just, this isn't just like come together, let's have popcorn and drink some soda and laugh. This is like we're going to generate income. We're going to generate energy. We're going to generate action for a specific service. We're going after something that's fallen between the cracks. And there are a lot of cracks between religion and politics. So many that some people don't want to let the two even touch. I was taught as a child, you want to get along with people, don't talk about religion, don't talk about politics. You know what that did in my little brain? It said, I can't wait to have a chance. I immediately went the other way. You know, you tell some people, don't do that, and they immediately want to do it. All right, let's see. What do you think? Was it you that asked it? Yes, I think that's so. Very good. Did we cover enough of it? Good. Anybody have any other questions or comments? Oh, here's a piece that I should comment on. Not to be attached. This is ridiculous, okay? The teachings aren't about being not attached. It's about seeing the nature of attachment as a transitory, impermanent, empty process to which there isn't anyone in there attaching. Just like there isn't anyone in here having the feelings and thoughts. They're just happening. Awareness sees this. So it's impossible to not be attached because there never was anyone who was attached. What there is in actuality is a tendency, like a reflex, a neurological muscular reflex that attaches and passes away, which you could call that passing away of attachment unattaching. I don't call it that. I just call it the nature of the attaching tendency appearing and disappearing. And when this is recognized, what it does in part is it dissolves the notion of someone who's going to become unattached. The notion of someone who's going to become unattached is born from the idea that if you, whoever you are, can become unattached, that's better than being attached. It's a common misperception, particularly in certain teachings, Buddhist teachings, because Buddhist emphasizes this attachment word a little bit more than Hinduism or Christianity or Sufism. You see this attachment word in Buddhist teachings more frequently. And so then the mind goes, oh, let's see now. I'm going to work on being unattached. Now I'm attached to being unattached. Yes, that's it. I'm working it out just fine. It's like me with the deviled eggs. Think about it. Okay? Attached to being silent and mindful. You know what it does when someone's like trying to be mindful? It makes them stiff and rigid. That's not how mindfulness works. Mindfulness is like perfectly tuned string of the lute or guitar. If you play some musical instrument that needs tuning, get the tuning just right. There it is. That's mindfulness. Not too tight, not too loose. Any other comments, questions?
So you talk about the seven factors sort of in he's kind of gone through, hey, there are seven factors, but like now what? Right? It's like, hey, I've got seven instruments as part of an orchestra.
Live them.
But now what? Okay.
Live them. Live them. See them. See them in your life. See them in your work. See them.
Got it.
See them. Live them. Let them grow. Have fun.
Spend some time in those.
Absolutely.
Get to know each one individually and get to know them how they...
Yeah, there you go, Sean. Okay. That's it, exactly. And you don't have to be formally meditating to do that. Because you know, when you go to work tomorrow, when I go to work tomorrow, there's going to be plenty of investigation going on, plenty of energy going on. There's probably going to be some joy going on. I don't know about spine tingling rapture. That's reserved for my Howley. That's the white... what person in Hawaiian culture call... Huh? Moke, yeah. Moke or Howley. My Howley friends in Hawaii, all they want is ecstasy.
My equivalent question is like, to say tranquility, and you talk a lot about emptiness and form, so it's like tranquility and... I mean, non-dualism is interesting, but like, I don't know, what if I'm just a mess?
Well, that's an idea or feeling.
Yeah.
That I'm a mess. Everything is actually non-dual, and what that simply means is that there aren't two. There's an appearance of two.
Right. So I guess my question is like, is tranquility part of being a mess? Like,
it would be yeah. It would be probably obscured from the sense of being a mess, but it's still in there. It's just not recognized. Like I'm not sure what you exactly mean by a mess, but it sounds messy, you know, the feeling of, you know, disturbance perhaps, or just twistedness or feeling. You know, I used to talk with a friend of mine about my difficult feelings, and we began to name them. He said, well, the first stage, Paul, is that you're twisted. And then the next stage is that you're bent. And then the next stage is that you're torqued.
And I was more like asking, like, philosophically, like, obviously there's those center factors, and we can live those, and then there's, like, the other stuff.
Like, well, there's other stuff, like, there's states of mind, and there's feelings that could get messy, but it's these factors and the recognizing of these factors that helps us sort the mess. Concentration helps sort the mess. Equanimity definitely helps sort the mess. Investigation, when you can investigate that which is messy. I mean, go anywhere. Go into your body if your body feels like it's in pain. Go in there, investigate it. I did this with this guy the other day. Wicked, wicked tension in the gut. Born from looking for approval left and right and center and over and over and over from the father who wasn't giving it. Simple, right? Huh? Deep gut pain. Probably a lot of anger in there, but he didn't really get to anger. He got to deep, deep, just tension hurt. And as he did that, it started to open up and release, and the pain started to dissolve. You investigate anything, you're going to start to see the nature of that. The nature of that mess is impermanent. It's not solid. It's like you said, Chloe, it's empty. That form, that messy form, is empty of permanence. It's empty of solidity. It's dancing particles. So the factors of awakening come in handy all the time. We're using them every day to some extent, whether we're formally meditating or not. As you said, Sean, just begin to notice them more readily. It's getting off of this subtle automatic pilot that's probably functional for most of us, you know. So if I asked you, how did your day go today? Not bad, maybe. Pretty good. A little messy this way or that, but, you know, pulled it off. You know, got here. How'd your sit go? The beginning of my sit? Messy. Oh, it was messy. All kinds of messy in here, Chloe. Mess. Oh, messy. And then it just started to sort out. You start to see how things take care of themselves. Life is taking care of itself. It's not just your digestive system and your heart and your lungs know what to do. The whole of consciousness knows how to be, how to self-regulate, how to self-care. And that's particularly relevant when it comes to the messy areas. So it is directly applicable. Investigate the messiness. Notice the energy of the messiness, what's happening to that. It's literally so direct that what looks messy at first can turn in its own time into joy. And those other factors are there. The concentration is there. The equanimity is there. Of course, the mindfulness is there. Otherwise, none of this is happening. Does that work? It's not working. Still messy.
Well, I mean, I feel like messy is a bad example because you go on that. I'm like, you talk about the aggregates, right?
Yeah.
But I think those are different than the factors.
They are.
Okay, so that's where I'm kind of being confused because, like, I'm not really understanding the difference. Like the aggregates are very clearly like states of mind, and that could be messy or that could not be messy. I don't want to use the example of messiness though, because I feel like the aggregates sort of describe experience.
That's right.
And then, but the factors are not describing experience.
The factors are describing experience in specific ways. They are describing what would be considered the wholesome aspects of experience that assist in the clarification of the aggregates. Aggregates, body, feeling, mental formation, perception, consciousness. How are you going to investigate consciousness without awareness? You can't investigate perception without awareness. You can't investigate emotional life without equanimity. So they work perfectly together. I'm really glad you were specific and made that statement you just made about the interface. And yes, these are two different teachings that are talking about the nature of human life differently.
Okay.
Body, feeling, thoughts, perception, consciousness. Five aggregates, that's this. Seven factors of awakening. Seven factors of awakening are specific qualities of mind. Specific qualities of intelligence that help the human clarify what they are.
Okay.
Less messy. There's a statement at the first verse of the Dhammapada that I often refer to. The Dhammapada was a book that came out after the Buddha had come and left. And it's a collection of the Buddha's teachings. It's often one or two liners. It's a great book, by the way. Dhamma means truth. Pada means foot. At foot of Dhamma, which is the same as Dharma, only it's the Pali word, Dhamma. The Sanskrit word is Dharma. Sounds a little more lofty for higher class. Dhammapada, at the foot of Dhamma. First line of the Dhammapada. Mind is a tangle. Who can untangle the tangle? Nice way to start a book. And it goes on to describe how it's done. Excuse me, that's wrong. That was a mess. I made a mistake. I just quoted the first verse of the Vasuddhimagga, not the Dhammapada. Gotta have my text right. The Dhammapada has an interesting opening line about the mind. It's similar to what I just said, but it's not what I just said. That first verse that I just mentioned is the first verse of the Vasuddhimagga. The Vasuddhimagga, that's a book, also a very, very beautiful book that's very terse and dense. Came out after the Buddha. Vasuddhimagga means the path of purification. These are classic books, classic teachings. Worth looking at sometime if you can stick with it and not get lost, because it's You know, there's a book that was written by Matthew Flickstein called Swallowing the River Ganges. It's a practical guide to the Vasuddhimagga. It is a really good book. Would you agree, Ib? Ibi, do I still have your copy? What's that?
You might. I got a new one.
Do you want it back? That's what it's like dealing with the messy bar of the book. Do you want it back before you go to Austin?
No, thank you.
Okay.
More books back.
It's a great book, by the way. I recommend. It's easy to read. I used to sponsor Matthew Flickstein a little bit when he was still around. He's a good teacher from Virginia. Not all the way up to Highview. He's in Rutgersville, Virginia, near Charlottesville. If he's still around. Is he still around, Ibby? Do you know?
I think he's retired from teaching, but he's around.
Yeah. He's beautiful. He's a beautiful, unique being. I remember seeing him at that very center in Highville before I met him. It wasn't that day that I got smeared with the deviled eggs. It was a different day. But we were in the kitchen, and Matthew, this was like 30 years ago or something, Matthew was there, and Matthew was completely composed. And I remember looking at him from the side, and I was just taken by the countenance. It was just so present. And then later I met him, got to know him a bit. Very sincere, very, very committed Dharma practitioner and teacher. Anything else tonight? Anything that needs clarification? Sean?
So I have a question. So in the meditation, the sitting, it is recommended to sort of bring the awareness right to the breath or something like that. Could you just bring the awareness to something else?
Well, that's a great question. The awareness doesn't really go anywhere. That's the difference again between awareness and attention. What you described is attention, and what you just described or what you asked about. Is there's lots of techniques of meditation, and there's lots of different instructions, and they can be quite nuanced and quite subtle, but all of them deal with the actual directness of experience, whether it be breathing, bodily experience, emotional experience, mental experience. What's going on here? And so there can be an investigation of any of these areas. Now, it just so happens that focusing on something like the breathing, which is there all the time, the breath is both a physical rhythm as well as a mental rhythm. Because if you get anxious, your breath will change. If you get calm, your breath will change. It's a physical as well as a mental rhythm. Okay, it's expressing the mind too. So when you focus on the breathing, it helps you connect to not just the body but also the mind, because the mind is in the breath. That's why it's a universal object for meditation and for concentration. And once there's enough stability and lack of discursiveness and restlessness and agitation, and there's some degree of calm, some degree of balance, some degree of equanimity and so forth, some balancing of these factors that I mentioned, then you can investigate other things. Meaning the attentiveness can go to other things. It can go into, like Daryl was going into, the sound. It can go into the body. Yeah,
a
big toe. Yes, why not? Hello, and then it can go into even very investigative into the whole thinking process without getting lost, without it having to become a messy thing.
Like joy, for example, could you just put the attention on something like joy?
If you can find out where it is, yeah, you could try that. I mean, I remember being taught the mantra in TM before Vipassana was even in this country. And I would focus on my mantra, which I'll tell you what it is. They told, don't say it to anybody. It loses its special ring if you do. You're going to wreck it. Okay. The mantra was Iyengar. And later, years later, when I'd stopped that whole mantra thing, I have nothing against it. It was fine. It was wonderful. I asked a lot of other people, hey, what was yours? They had the same mantra. So they made it seem very special that you get this mantra. But it's like if you just said your name over and over, Paul, 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 it sounds not as good as Iyengar. Iyengar. You know, if you just dog, you said dog, you know, something over and over, God, whatever. You just repeat something over and over, you get concentrated, your mind will go towards calmness and will eventually go towards joy. I figured this out. I used to do Iyengar, 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 Iyengar. When I wasn't sleeping, drooling, I'd go into like joy and I'd come out, Sean, and I'd be like, whoa! I'd be like really happy. I didn't know what I was doing really. I was just very naive, but you know, it's there. It's tapping into it. So what doesn't really work is that if you're trying to find joy directly, like we started out tonight, David Brooks' comment, you know, joy comes as a byproduct for those who are looking for something else. Where are you going to find it? Is it in the wall? Well, guess what? It is in a way. But are you open enough to see that? You know, you stop and you look at a gecko. I mean, I did that today. I looked at this gecko and then I decided that I was going to try to touch it. I mean, am I being too personal?
And the
gecko, you know, it's like he'd let me touch his tail and then he wouldn't, you know. And it all became very interesting. And the next thing you know, it was like pretty happy. Just having a gecko moment. So yeah, the joy is there, but it's not really in the object that you're looking at, Sean, or
yeah,
related to. It's in you.
Yeah.
It's in you.
I feel that sometimes I can kind of see it. I can,
yeah,
something will happen.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, hey, if I just keep going a little bit more, then it's like, oh, well, it's like it's happy instead.
Yes.
It's similar, like, if I'm having just a shitty day, like sometimes I'm like, you know, I'm just not going to have a shitty day anymore. I'm like, wow, can I do that? I'm like, yeah. Oh, that's nice. I'm not having a shitty day anymore.
There you go. That's called the non-process process. Yeah. Now, some people say, oh, you just like made up your mind to do something different. No, I think it's a little bit deeper than that. It's like what you just described is like this couple that I used to love as a child, and we used to visit with them. They were older than my parents even. They were great. It was Dick and Vivian. Dick and Vivian. Dick was a lawyer, and he was very... And Vivian was always loving everybody and getting them a hamburger, right? And so they were playing Scrabble. And it was the last time I saw them, maybe 25 years ago, the last time I physically saw them. And I visited them in their little cottage up in Maine, where we all would hang out, you know, in the summers. And they were playing Scrabble. And they were talking to me some, and then suddenly something came up between them. This is a couple that had probably been together for 60 years. Or more. And something came up between them, and it was super clear that it was tense. And I don't know what it was, but I could feel it. I was about 28 years old at the time or something, and I had done a little meditation, and I had a little awareness, and I knew what pain felt like. Emotional pain. And it was like, whoa! You know, and I was looking at them like frozen. And all of a sudden, Sean, without a word, they just dropped it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, I don't have a shitty day.
Yeah.
Now, some people say, oh, you're just defending. You're just, you know, shifting your attitude. You're just focusing differently. I'd say, maybe. But I think you're talking about something much more profound, much more beautiful, much more intelligent. Just drop it. It's not repression, it's not suppression. And then see if that doesn't bring a nice sense to the moment. I think it's much more than just changing the channel, like cognitive therapy will teach people to refocus the attention. We've got anxiety, anxious thoughts, refocus the attention, redirect the attention. Put a stop sign up on those thoughts, and then change your attention. This is way, way different what you're talking about here. It's way deeper. It's not reframing. It's Dick and Vivian Vale. Boom. A la Sean.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I know. See, the problem with this that I was just talking about is that it sometimes creates a sense of, I don't know what you're talking about. Because it doesn't feel like it's possible sometimes, because we're used to processing things, we're used to working on things, we're used to delving in and sometimes very much in there getting caught in things. And so this is not something that one can take very lightly and just, oh yeah. You know how many people defensively will try to be in a different place? You know how many people tell other people, oh, you're still grieving? Your dog died 2 weeks ago. Come on, party. You're not smiling any of those? You know, trying to be helpful? You ever have somebody do that to you? You ever somebody try to give you a hug when you don't want one? For themselves? Yeah, you need that. Yeah, really? But you ask me first. So, these are not contradictory, Chloe. This drop-it business is not contradicted by sometimes, maybe quite a bit of the time, things need to be investigated and seen through. And that may seem to take some time. Complexes of emotion, different sort of encrusted sort of beliefs about things, opinions, judgments. Let's just say that I've been criticized, which I have, but let's just say I've been criticized and that's affected me, and I feel my own repository, my own template of having been criticized. I might not be able to just do that with that. I couldn't do that with the deviled eggs thing. You know how disturbed I was for hours after the deviled eggs? I'll just get that out here now, okay? I didn't just go back to my kuti. Oh, that was fine. I was like, probably thought I should just quit the whole thing, just go home, have a hot dog, and call it a day. I hung in there. So, transformation is always instantaneous, but it doesn't necessarily appear to be happening smooth and easy like this. This conditioned mind-body process is the laboratory for investigation. It is the living scientific experiment that has been given as the portal, as the ground, as the garden for insight. And that is a very, very deep and at times complicated, which is again not contradictory to the simple, just I can shift like Sean said, because that doesn't really work that way. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Can you condition children in such a way that it's not so messy? Like this mess that went on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, what's happening though, if you, because children aren't messy generally unless it's
make them messy.
They get messy, yeah. But they do come in a little messy sometimes. You know, depending on the circumstances, you know, around the mother's state. Because there's 9 months in there, past conception of development. And let's be clear, even though this development is apparently invisible, it's happening. There's a lot going on in there. And so conditioning is already unfolding in the womb. And then the body comes out, and as you point out, you know, additional conditions are often unconsciously, you know, placed upon that child. Now the good news about conditions, even if you would do one's best to like improve upon how you were parented, if you become a parent and do it better, that's most parents feel that way. I'll do it better than how it was done with me. You will still mess up. You will still be unconscious. You will still make mistakes. The gift of love and compassion is that it's forgiving. This isn't about like not entering the stream of conditioning. There's no way you come here in the form that you're in and not have an encounter with conditioning. That is absolutely necessary. There wouldn't be any awakening unless there was conditioning. So the conditions, you know, we would like them to be not overwhelming. You know, the conditions, for example, in Haiti are completely and utterly overwhelming right now. I mean, it's just incredible. Again, like what? It is so, so bad. And so many people are suffering so intensely with those conditions. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just, it's unimaginable. Again, you know, how many times is that going to keep happening on the planet? And then, you know, the struggle to even figure out what to do, never mind when to do it and how to do it. So the conditioning and the encounter with conditioning is absolutely critical. It is the curriculum that we need in order for the awakening to occur. And yes, you can raise kids, you know, like tokus are raised, you know, very carefully usually, like the Dalai Lama and various other Tibetan tokus, they're raised very, very carefully, you know, very carefully. They're very much taken care of from a very early age. And they're given teachings when they're very, very young. You know, imagine being taught about the factors of awakening and you're 3 years old and you're just, or 5 years old, you're just ready to hear it. And then the teachings are being given. You're being taught to meditate and concentrate on your breathing and you're 4 years old.
Basically the same thing as Sesame Street, right?
Say what?
Basically the same thing as Sesame Street.
On a good day, yeah. On a good day, yeah. If you can see that there. Yeah, Sesame Street. Well, thank you for coming. It's 9 o'clock, actually a few minutes past. Appreciate your attention tonight. And I'll see you when I see you.